The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We had been mentioning that Jasper was interested in man. He began with the study of law, but he had read some philosophy, had read Spinoza. He began to study medicine as the best means of learning the nature of man. He studied psychiatry. He became a theoretical assistant, as we said, at the psychological clinic in Heidelberg. And in 1913, he began to teach as a Privatdozent in psychology in Heidelberg. I had mentioned that I think a private instructor or a private lecturer. You are familiar with the term, I suppose, Privatdozent. A Privatdozent would be one who then has the right to instruct in an institution, but is not one who receives a salary, who receives a stipend or a salary from the university itself. He would receive fees for his instruction. When I was at Union Theological Seminary in New York years ago, we had a person who had that kind of position instructing in German. You would pay him directly for his instruction, and he was not paid by the seminary itself. We don't have that kind of thing here, at least formally. Well, in this period, to go on, he read Edmund Husserl. Edmund Husserl, E-D-M-U-N-D. Husserl, H-U-S-S-E-R-L. Husserl is then a very well-known philosopher, a founder of the contemporary phenomenological movement. And he also read Max Weber. Max Weber had a profound influence on him. Yes, capital M-A-X, of course, Max, and then Weber, capital W-E-B-E-R. And also, we mentioned Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish thinker, Søren Kierkegaard. Perhaps everyone knows how to spell that, but it's capital S-O with a slash through the O-R-E-N. And then Kierkegaard, capital K-I-E-R-K-E-G-A-A-R-D. The A-A in double A in Danish with an O sound, Kierkegaard. Well, Husserl had developed a descriptive psychology, what you might call a descriptive psychology. Jaspers thought of the phenomenological method as a good means to describe psychological illnesses. And so if you're going to describe psychological illnesses, then use a phenomenological method, which would be a descriptive method. Husserl himself commented that Jaspers had used the phenomenological method well. Now, Jaspers didn't particularly appreciate that comment. But Husserl did comment about Jaspers, that Jaspers had used the phenomenological method well. But Jaspers was not altogether pleased, because he objected to Husserl's use of phenomenological method as a mean of strict scientific investigation. Now, what Husserl had tried to do here was to find a way around the relativism of the time, relativistic thinking, and in the course we have mentioned a couple of sources of relativistic thinking. For one thing, historicism is a source of relativistic thinking. We mentioned something about that. And psychologism would be a source of relativistic thinking. We've said something about that. Husserl was particularly opposed to psychologism, a psychologistic way of thinking. And in order to avoid that, he tried to reintroduce the idea of philosophy as a strictly scientific discipline. How then can we rise above this relativism? By having a philosophy that is strictly scientific. Now, Jaspers said this is impossible. And as we go then into Jaspers' thinking, we'll see that he rejects this idea. Jaspers indeed used the phenomenological method, but in his own view, he did so not as a means or not in the interest of developing a doctrine, a teaching, something that can be, let's say, well-founded, a well-founded body of knowledge. By the way, let me say it before I forget it again. We did come up with the name of that book that we were talking about last hour. It's Roots of Western Culture. The Doy Vert book is Roots of Western Culture. So if any of you were on pins and needles all during the interim, now you may be relieved of your frustrations so that we do not have to write a phenomenological treatise on you and your psychical difficulties, whatever. But in any case, Jaspers thought of this phenomenological method, but not in the interest of developing a doctrine. He wanted it to avoid reductionistic methods. He wanted to use it to avoid then theoretical dogmatisms, as he called it. Now, a phenomenological method then, according to him, would be descriptive. It would not come in then with a sort of a cookie-cutter approach that you have certain value judgments and this and that and the other, you have a certain metaphysical order. That we've talked about these things earlier in the course. What you have to do is level all that, put all this aside, and come in with a purely descriptive method, what is called in a descriptive method along this line, along a phenomenological line. And in that, he thought, Jaspers thought, we could avoid reductionism. We could avoid a reductionism of psychologism. We could avoid a reductionism of historicism, and this and that and the other. We could avoid what he called theoretical dogmatisms. Yes?
It just seems to me from what you've told us in his life so far that he has a lot of problems with authority in general.
He has problems with authority in general.
Yeah.
Very much so. Well, we just mentioned this, that he had trouble with authority in his youth. That is, he reacted against it. That is, for him, you know, that's just a bit of information. But this rebellion from authority, as we shall see, is written into Jaspers' entire position. We're going to come against the idea that if we're going to have this philosophical faith of which we were talking, one moment or one side of our attitude then has to be rebellion. There has to be this idea of rebellion before we can accept anything. The idea of rebellion, the idea of resistance to authority is going to be worked into his position very intimately, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. Now, his method also, Osper's method drew from the so-called method of empathetic understanding. We have mentioned that already, I believe, the idea of Verstehen, and or empathetic understanding. In the German is capital V-E-R-S-T-E-H-E-N, Verstehen. And this method is associated with the name of Wilhelm Dilthey, the Wilhelm, capital W-I-L-H-E-L-M, and Dilthey, capital D-I-L-T-H-E-Y. The idea for Stan, or empathetic understanding. And he then used this method to examine things, to avoid the idea, a reductionistic idea, he thought, that we might be able to understand the phenomena of the human spirit in terms of brain processes, for example. That we could understand the processes of the human spirit in terms of certain physical processes, let's say, in the brain. So, all along, Jasper has opposed the idea that mental illness is illness of the brain, that there's something simply physiologically wrong with someone. He dubbed this view brain mythology, here in mythologie. It would be a mythology. In other words, you're taking a view, you are absolutizing something, you're taking a perspective and absolutizing it, and you are then, as I said here earlier, you're entering into a dogmatism and saying that you can understand all disturbances in the human spirit in terms of causal factors related to physiological situation in the brain. He dubbed this brain mythology. He also opposed the method of psychoanalysis. He opposed the method of psychoanalysis. He admired the work of Freud, Sigmund Freud, when he thought that the latter was scientific. Now it's interesting that Jaspers interprets Freud in a certain way. If you read my booklet on psychology, you will notice that I interpret Freud along this line too. Jaspers interpreted Freud in this fashion, that Freud himself had used the method of Verstehen. Now what would that mean? See, Jaspers is trying to avoid understanding mental illness in terms of aberrations in the brain. All right, then if you're going to avoid that, where do you look? You're going to look at then the quote-unquote spiritual side of man, and or the meaning side of man, and you're going then to look try to see this as a unit, not reduce it to something else, but to see it then in its integrity. He said that Freud had used the method of Verstehen. His problem then, he had thought in terms of meaning, the meaning life of man, and had tried to understand it in terms of meaning, in meaning relationships, but he had absolutized it. He had absolutized it. Yes?
Maybe you just answered my question. I was going to say, if Jaspers wanted to avoid scientific reductionism, mm-hmm. then why was it the only thing that in Freud he liked was his scientific writing?
Well, apparently he thought that at least in Freud's scientific writing, he had been, for Jaspers, quote-unquote objective. I mean, he had truly been objective, is where Freud began to absolutize things, that he got into these into the false thing. You'll see how this fits in Jasper's thinking later on. But it is possible. In fact, we mentioned Max Weber. He was very fond of Max Weber because, in Max Weber's analyses, because he thought that they were they stuck to the facts, and that it was truly scientific approach. So he's not against science, but he would be against the idea that science should be the only aspect of things, and certainly against what he would think of any absolutization of any side of man. Freud had absolutized, he said, Verstehen. Now, psychoanalysis had attempted to obtain a doctrine of man, a doctrine of the human unconscious, so that man could come into control of the forces molding his life. Psychoanalysis then had tried then to obtain a doctrine of man, a doctrine of the human unconscious, so that man could come into control of the forces which mold his life. Now, Jaspers, as we shall see, is against that kind of thing. To fix something, to get it in your gaze, to focus in on it, and so that you can use that then as a springboard for control. We'll see that that is a definite view of his. Jaspers also opposed the position of Marxism. Now, he has a view of Marxism and of Karl Marx and Marxism that does not coincide with what I have understood as the more recent interpreters of Marx. He interprets Marx simply as an undialectical dogmatist, and we'll see that as we go along, and of course many others do too. But, well, let's just follow along with what Jasper says about Karl Marx. He opposed the position of Marxism as a striking example of dogmatism. And he rejected it then as one of the, of course, closed positions. And not open, but a closed position in our time. In contrast to these, he wanted this method of empathetic understanding. He thought this was the method par excellence of what is now called the human sciences. In German, I think it's much more expressive, it's the Geisteswissenschaften. That's a pretty long word, but I'll spell it anyway. Capital G-E-I-S-T-E-S-W-I-S-S-E-N-S-C-H-A-F-T-E-N. Now, good luck, okay? The Geisteswissenschaften, which is translated into English as human sciences, which seems to me sort of inadequate. The closer translation that's closer is the sciences of the human spirit. Some people have said spiritual sciences. I said that, and somebody got after me one time and said, well, as you talk about spiritual sciences, people won't know what you're talking about. Well, maybe that's true. I'm not the only one that has translated that way. Perhaps a little bit more accurate, the sciences of the human spirit. But just to say human sciences, that doesn't please me very much either. So I don't have much choice often but to use the German, which is expressive, the Geisteswissenschaften. This, then, he thought, was the method appropriate to the human spirit. And he then thought of it this way, that spiritual processes, or processes of the human spirit, had to be in turn understood in other terms of other processes of the human spirit. They had to be understood then within the spiritual totality, the spiritual complex, or the complex of operations or whatever of the human spirit. Now, Jaspers was the first to use this method in psychotherapy. He was the first one to use this method in psychotherapy. And it then came to be expressed in his influential Psychopathologie, or the pathology of the psyche or the human spirit, and Psychopathologie. Now, as we have said, he employed this method in the interests of combating what he regarded to be reductive attitudes, dogmatic positions in science, against reductionism, against then dogmatic positions in science. To this he set, opposed to this, he set then this method of the science, this method of the science of the human spirit, you might say, or the Geisteswissenschaften. And he was the first then to use this kind of method of empathetic understanding in the area of psychopathology. Well, in this line, he insisted that it is then impossible to obtain a picture of man, a final, a complete, an ultimate picture of man. Instead, one must content oneself with obtaining perspectives. So you can't get an overall view of man. You have then to be able to get perspectives. You cannot get an ultimate picture, an ultimate doctrine of man. You must get look at it from perspectives. In this effort, it's impossible to do anything else but use varying methods. You use this kind of method, you use that kind of method, and in doing so, you can open up some understanding about man. But it is impossible, he said, to attain the doctrine of man, to obtain a total view. Now, instead then of using insights as a tool, that you have this insight, that perspective, instead of using these as a tool, people have elevated such methods into an all-embracing faith. They've elevated them into an all-embracing faith. So you look at one aspect of things and you elevate that, he said, into an all-embracing faith. That is, you then believe in it, you then elevate that, and so you see everything from that perspective, as if that, from that perspective you could obtain a view of man in his totality. Well, what is he going to set up over against this? He's going to try to come out with what we call a philosophical faith. Not a dogmatic faith, of which we were just speaking, but a philosophical faith. And one has to see how he tries to get over there. Another thing, if he's going to get a view of man, how does he get a view of man in his totality? Because if we're going to talk from our own point of view, we might very well say that it's impossible to get a view of man unless you have some notion of totality. What then, how are you going to approach that problem? A question for us too, if we have a view of man that is a scripturally oriented view of man, which I fervently trust that we have, then does that mean that we have a dogmatism? Or is it somewhat analogous to what Jaspers is saying? That is, only from a truly Christian point of view, from a truly biblical point of view, that we can avoid false dogmatisms. Now, that is a viewpoint which is pursued by Hermann Dooyeweerd, of whom we mentioned, and we talked about his Roots of Western Culture. There are other books available, but that, the position in his Transcendental Critique, he tries to show that it's only from a truly Christian position that we can avoid, open up the cosmos for what it truly is and avoid hurtful dogmatisms. So, I mean, there are this kind of question that come up at this point, but Jaspers now is going to try to avoid dogmatism. He's going to try to avoid elevating some aspect of things into a total faith, but yet he's going to try then with all that to get a view of what he calls philosophical faith, and that will give him an all-embracing means of approaching things.
Was
Dooyeweerd influenced by Jaspers? According to my best knowledge, the answer to that is simply no, he wasn't. He did, however, refer to Jaspers' psychology of worldviews in his early writings. And so he had read this early work. We'll mention the psychology of worldviews later. But he did mention Carl Jaspers in some of his early works, but to my knowledge, he was not influenced. Now the question does come, however, whether Dooyeweerd was influenced by the phenomenological movement in general, and that would be, he did pass through the thinking of Edmund Husserl. He was very captivated by that for a while, and some people have said that he never really overcame it. That's a neat question. I happen to think that, I've never really bought into that notion. But it is a question that is a question that is asked, and that is the kind of question one can look into. Yes? Well, now you say in avoiding dogmatism, is he going to come up with the idea of tabula rasa? The way I've been approaching things in this course, I've maintained that all of the existential thinkers have the encounter with nothingness. And Jaspers is going to have that just like the other ones. And if you want to call that tabula rasa, that's not the word I've used, but it's not tabula rasa, simply an empty slate. And if you have the idea of nothingness, that's pretty empty to me. So anyway, well, let's follow along here, but we shall find, and I did mention that later on, Jaspers is going to deal with various oppositions, and one of the oppositions he's going to deal with is Trotz and Hingabe. Hingabe is the simple giving yourself over to something. Trotz is is this rebellious opposition to something that of which Jaspers is speaking, and you cannot be dedicated to anything apart from the dialectical opposite, namely that you are resisting any intrusion, that you assert your own autonomy over against all authority. So that is going to be a very definite a mark of his thinking. All right. Now, we go on. There is also the influence of Max Weber's life and method on Carl Jaspers. Max Weber, he's the second person we mentioned here, capital M-A-X, capital W-E-B-E-R. He became interested in Weber in 1909. Now for him, Weber became the model of scientific investigation. The model of scientific investigation. And the reason for this is that Weber did not try to get an overall point of view. He did not try then to get a global point of view. Now, this is Jaspers speaking, not the instructor here. But that he investigated factual situations, factual relationships, honestly and scientifically. Now, we had mentioned that, in a fashion, Jaspers employed the phenomenological method of Husserl, but he was disappointed with Husserl's idea that philosophy is an exact science. What is philosophy? Jaspers is going to think of philosophy, as I mentioned, philosophical faith. It's not a science. It is a faith, but a certain kind of faith. Now, Husserl, on the other hand, according to Jaspers, had tried to make philosophy, as we say, an exact scientific method. He had attempted to erect philosophy on a more exact scientific basis in order to overcome the crisis of the sciences. One of Husserl's books is the crisis of the sciences. It has to do with the crisis of Europe and in connection with the crisis, the scientific crisis, or the crisis of the sciences. And he wanted to overcome this by a philosophical approach where he could put philosophy on a more exact scientific foundation. Jaspers, as we said, thought this was a cardinal mistake. If we're going to be scientific, then we take Max Weber as our model, because Weber limited himself critically to particular investigations, particular relationships, the relationship of capitalism and the Reformation, for example. What's the relationship of capitalism and the Reformation? I sometimes think in some disgust as I read the literature that comes into our house, Time Magazine, etc. Some of the less popular literature, perhaps, but at least that tells you everything, at least all the nutty things that are going on in the universe, and there are plenty of those. I think that everybody must have read Tawney's book in university. What is it, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism? Because they're all filled with the Weber hypothesis, and Tawney was in the school of Weber, and they interpret things along this line. I get the sinking feeling that everybody must have read Tawney's book. Well, Weber did examine the relationship between capitalism and the Reformation. What's the relationship here? And as you know, this has been examined. The view that's very widely broad is that of the Weber Tawney theory. But there's no effort, Jaspers said, in Weber to come to a general view. Now this I don't understand at all, but this is what Jaspers said. He presented clear analyses that remain close to scientific practice. Now I'm not stating my own position here, I'm just trying to introduce us to where Jaspers is going. Now, it is the case, from our point of view, at least from the point of view I present in the institution, if one be empirical and look at the facts, if one remains close to practice, doesn't just fly off in some idealistic splurge himself idealistically, but sticks close to practice, it doesn't mean that one can escape presuppositions. And these will then involve certain general assumptions. Now, in the secularization course, which some of you may have taken, I know at least a couple of people in here have taken that course, I come up with this formula in there: be as scientific as you will, you will not then be able to escape basing your position on presuppositions. And I would answer that here. Now, presupposition is not then per se on the order of generalization from the particulars. You might say, okay, stick with the particulars, and then all generalizations are simply abstractions, and that your presuppositions then are the notion of abstractions or generalizations from the particulars. Jaspers tends in this direction here. In his view of science, He assumes a positivistic view that science will simply deal with facts and relationships, particular relationships between the facts. And this view, if I'm not sadly mistaken, stays with him. It remains with him during his entire career. And it will come up later on in when he is discussing what he thinks of as the encompassing, the encompassing, or the in German is the umgreifende, the capital U-M-G-R-E-I-F-E-N-D-E, the umgreifende. In my dissertation, I call that the all-enclosing, is something that encloses something. But the term that is most often used is encompassing, or the umgreifende. What he will do, he will then interpret this encompassing, the encompassing, as he calls it, of consciousness in general, the encompassing of consciousness in general, Bewusstsein überhaupt, or consciousness in general, he will interpret that in a positivistic fashion, but we'll get there later on. Now, for Jaspers, going further, the very fragmentary character of Weber's labors, because it wasn't only that Weber limited himself to factual analysis, analyzing certain factual relationships, but his life itself was fragmentary. I can relate in real life to this somewhat, because if you try to do all kinds of things and meet all kinds of demands coming to you from your home and the church and the seminary and the various programs in the seminary and so forth, sometimes you feel like you're just sort of being pulled apart. Now, you students here at the seminary at Westminster have that experience of being pulled apart from time to time, too. But, all right, so our lives sometimes tend to fragmentize, and we have to be very careful about that. We have then to draw them together and get a focus. Now, just since we're on the homiletical vein here, let me say what my senior professor, Dr. Van Til, told me one time, which I've been kept very much in mind, and that he says, I do those things which are most important. Well, that's very fine. If you're going to do that, however, you probably have to have somebody else tending the kitchen around the place while you're doing that, because I don't mean in any slight whatsoever, but in the earlier days of the seminary, it was Professor Woolley who was tending store all the time, all the detailed matters he was taking care of with his genius for such things, which would give other people some more freedom. But apart from all that, that is very true. One has to narrow down, one has then to fix his attention in a meaningful way, and so he does not then fragmentize, so he does not become, because there are forces in life which tend to do precisely that. Well, according to Jaspers, Weber's life was characterized by this fragmentariness. And Jaspers asked this question, and this question was very, very important to him, whether such a fragmentary life and labors, life and work, life and labors, could have ultimate significance. Here you do this, and you don't quite finish that, and so on and so on, and your life becomes fragmentary. Can this then have any ultimate significance? Now, Jaspers is going to come to the conclusion, and this is at the very heart of his thinking, he was going to answer that it was precisely in the foundering of our projects, as the our projects run aground, you might say, as our boat sinks off the horizon. You'll say, is your boat coming? Well, my boat is always sunk just before it re-soars. That's so you hear some people saying that sometimes. But Jasper said it was precisely in the foundering, in the failure, you might say, of our projects that the transcendent would be able to appear. Jaspers is going to try to find an ultimate source of being and meaning, and according to him, it would be precisely in this foundering, in this shipwreck, or in the German Scheitern, capital S-C-H-E-I-T-E-R-N, in Scheitern, that he says, he'll say, im Scheitern das Sein zu erfahren, to experience being then precisely in this foundering, or in this shipwreck, or in this failure. Now from 1916, Jaspers taught psychology as a professor extraordinarius at Heidelberg. A professor extraordinarius is different from a professor ordinarius. I suppose you might think of an ordinarius as a full professor. Extraordinarius would be one who was more an assistant, or and we might, well, professors of this type in this country sometimes are called adjunct professors. That probably doesn't fit too well. But at least he was not a full professor, an ordinarius. He was an extraordinarius at Heidelberg. Now, in 1920, Max Weber died. And Jaspers followed him in 1921 as a full professor of philosophy, again at Heidelberg. So Jaspers moved over into philosophy at Heidelberg and coming into the place that had been occupied by Max Weber. He came in then after Max Weber died in 1920. Well, if you want to say fiat, you may do that and then try to proceed along that line. Again, here's what we've been talking about for a long time. In the encounter with nothingness, you have to go through that, and it's precisely there that you find being and meaning. And when everything is falling apart, and precisely in the fragmentariness of our existence, is it possible to find unconditional truth there? Jaspers said, yes. And that will be then very important to his reflection on the self, what he will call human existence or existence.
So the foundering of projects is the motor operation of the,
yeah, well,
of
that,
the envelope falling away.
Yeah, we're talking about Weber now, and his projects were not brought, a lot, many of them, to completion and this and that, this fragmentariness of his life. So I'm speaking more in those terms, but you are right. We have used the term before, when the envelope of meaning falls away and things then become all at loose ends, what then? Jaspers said it's precisely then. You just don't try then to pick things up again and put them together, but it's precisely in that circumstance that there can be the experience, quote unquote, of being. And one of his slogans in the German, as I say, will be "Im Scheitern das Sein zu erfahren," or that you experience, quote unquote, being precisely then in this shipwrecking. Yes.
It sounds like Jaspers is coming to an existential view kind of by himself. Was he influenced by any other intellectual?
Well. Yeah, he was one of the major original figures here. One finds, we mentioned his Psychology of Worldviews, the Psychologie der Weltanschauungen, which is one of his early works. In there are extensive references to Kierkegaard and to Nietzsche. And so this just didn't come from anywhere. But Jaspers was one of those who founded the more contemporary existential movement, but he has a peculiar cachet. It's true of Heidegger and Sartre and Jaspers. These three men we're looking at here, they're pretty original. But as I say, he quotes extensively. He had done extensive study of Kierkegaard and was very familiar with Nietzsche. And he regarded these two men as those who really stuck out in the 19th century. They were the mavericks, you might say, in the 19th century, and harbingers of things to come. Now, another influence, and this is just what we've been talking about, on Karl Jaspers was Søren Kierkegaard. I mentioned Kierkegaard and spelled his name earlier, and be sure you say Gore and not Gard. Shall we then allow our good American language to be influenced so much by the European? Well, as long as it's a good American, I don't mind. I mean that we use it, but I must say I fear for our language. When I listen to the broadcasters on the sports programs, what they don't do with the English language, it's frightful. I sit there just almost in lingual agony sometimes. But at any rate, maybe you don't have the same problems. But now, the existentialist then, Jaspers, was one who was most directly related to Kierkegaard. If you think of Jaspers' position, it is reminiscent of Kierkegaard a fair amount. However, he rejected much of what Kierkegaard said, especially in regard to the latter's Christian confession. Now, as I mentioned, he has a view of Marx that doesn't have the same flavor as interpretations that refer to the so-called young Marx, or the there's been reinterpretation of Marx. Jaspers' interpretation doesn't seem to be influenced by that. As far as Kierkegaard is concerned, he has a rather straightforward and maybe not terribly sophisticated interpretation of Jaspers' Christian confession. But he stands close to Kierkegaard. Nevertheless, he rejects much that Kierkegaard said, especially in regard to the latter's Christian confession. He rejected, as we shall see more clearly later on, the idea of the incarnation. The idea of the incarnation, God's incarnation in human flesh. And of course, as you know, Kierkegaard wrestled with that idea and his idea of the moment filled with eternity. Jaspers, along the line, as we shall see, that thinks of the incarnation as a blasphemy to reason. If you have the idea of the incarnation, that's a blasphemy to reason. Jaspers also set up the idea of reason against the paradox. Kierkegaard, with his idea of the paradox, the religion of paradox, namely religion B, which would be Christianity, over against religion A, which is non-paradoxical religion. Jaspers sets himself up over against the idea of the paradox. If I may put it myself, rather crudely, in the line of Kierkegaard, you have a paradoxic idea of paradox, that really God is unable to reveal himself in our finite existence, but he does so anyway. in spite of the fact that he can't, he does. And that idea of paradox has come over into contemporary theology, as you know. Well, Jaspers then very much against the idea of the incarnation, against the idea of paradox, but on the other hand, he held to ideas very similar to those of Kierkegaard concerning decision, the decision process, the existential decision. And in fact, his philosophy, like the theology of Kierkegaard, might be regarded as a call to decision or an appeal to decision. Jaspers makes a great deal of the idea of appeal. And he associates existence or our existing, our being ourselves in our existence, with the idea of elevation, that is a transcending. In the German Aufschwung, capital AUFSCHWUNG, an Aufschwung. You might think of an Aufschwung, I guess, as the leap of a ballet dancer or something like that, in, way into the air, just a rising, a flight, enthusiasm, an Aufschwung. There is, in his thinking, and we shall stop with this today, as in Kierkegaard, what Jaspers calls double transcendence. I analyzed this extensively in my doctoral dissertation. It corresponds to what Kierkegaard called the double movement of infinity. The double movement of infinity, which we examine at some length in the contemporary theology course and some things. But Jaspers speaks of double transcendence, what Kierkegaard referred to as the double movement of infinity. Namely, if you're going to be yourself, there has to be an elevation, there has to be an Aufschwung, there has to be a moving out, you might say, of the world, and then a return, an encounter with infinity, and then a return to the moment with a difference. This was the pattern that Kierkegaard presented in terms of his idea of the moment filled with eternity, and this pattern is going to be very important to Jaspers' idea of the self in its relationship to the transcendent, but we're going to have to continue with such ideas next time.